Hey guys, we have a special offer for Radio Rothbard listeners. Ryan has a new book out, Breaking Away, The Case for Secession, Radical Decentralization, and Smaller Polities. Again, this is the secession book you need. I know it's a topic that a lot of you guys are interested in, always a big winner when we have it on the site, in our podcasts. And you can get a discount on your copy of this book using the promo code Rothpod, that is R-O-T-H-P-O-D. The book just came out. We debuted it at our 40th anniversary event. Ryan has a great talk on the subject. Check it out at our YouTube channel. Everywhere else, you can get your Mises Institute content. And so again, that is promo code Rothpod, R-O-T-H-P-O-D, and you'll get a 20% off discount on your order.
Hello and welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McVacon. I'm a senior editor here at the Mises Institute. And with me, of course, is my co-host, Tho Bishop, my associate editor at the Mises Institute as well. And let's just talk about a little bit about our bubble economy and how it relates to, say, the crypto bubbles, the Silicon Valley and the tech bubble. Because we're starting to see a different reality emerge in these places now that interest rates are going back up. And if you remember the last boom, an interesting thing happens when booms come to an end. So a very similar thing happened in 2008, 2009, is you have a lot of people who started out rich at the beginning of the boom. They made a whole lot of money during the boom. Because it's easy to make money. If you already own a lot of assets, you just buy more and then you make money because they're flooding the economy with more money. But these people, they let it go to their head. They start to think of themselves as geniuses, and that's why they're rich, and that's why they got richer, and they're smarter than everybody else. And then when the interest rates start to rise, when the money starts to tighten and things start to go bust and asset prices start to go down, we realize these people weren't really all that smart after all. There's exceptions, of course. There's real entrepreneurs in here. But a lot of these people, they made money because they were in a bubble economy. And they bought the right stuff in that bubble, which was most any asset. That's the thing, is you didn't have to have any particular insight into which assets to buy. And so if you bought a bunch of, a bunch of these cryptos, these non-Bitcoin cryptos on leverage, they were making a lot of money the last couple of years. And you probably just figured you were a genius because you were making a bunch of money there. But now that interest rates are starting to go up, a lot of the value is starting to go down. And you've got organizations like FTX going bankrupt. You've got organizations like Genesis. You're now starting to hear about that Coinbase is in trouble. A lot of these exchanges, it's the leveraged crypto. But then that's, of course, not it. You're starting to hear about layoffs at Amazon. Twitter shed more than half of its staff. I don't know what they were doing. We're supposed to be on Twitter death watch, but Twitter's still there, and I haven't even noticed any difference in the performance of Twitter at all. So it's very interesting to now see some of the finger-pointing. Twitter would have had to cut back staff anyway, just as Facebook is cutting back staff, just as Amazon is. It's not just because Elon came in. It's because these Silicon Valley workers just simply aren't that productive to justify the amount of money that was being poured into these salaries because money was easy to come by. We were in essentially a tech bubble, just like we're in a crypto bubble, just like we're in a real estate bubble, which is also now starting to pop. And it's remarkable how little it has required of interest rates to move up to start to see real turmoil in these markets. And the geniuses who assured us that they knew just the right place to put all their money, well, turns out they didn't have any real insight after all. So we're just going to look at sort of some of the, we'll cover a little bit of the economics, but also this is Radio Rothbard, so we'll do some of the more fun stuff too, such as how the media treats these people, just some of the regulatory issues involved, just sociological effects of these bubbles. So I assume you've been following a lot of this stuff and just how remarkable it is that these people just consistently act like they don't know what hit them and that it's all just come out of nowhere. And It's just beyond fathoming that these geniuses aren't making a whole boatload of money anymore.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting, when we talk about the bubbles here, I think there is an interesting component that is very well connected with the FTX stuff, and I think it is going to be one of the more interesting narratives going forward, is that I think we can think of this as a popping of the effective altruism bubble. And I remember reading back in 2008, right? So you know, this was the collapse of the financial crisis. This is the starting of the new the new bubble that we've been enjoying, you know, ever since. There was a project, a phrase that Bill Gates popularized for a brief period of time called creative capitalism. And there was actually a very interesting book. It was a kind of collection of articles by Warren Gates and all these very serious business leaders. Trying to figure out how to intermingle their private gains with their broader philanthropic causes, right? And this is has played into the larger dynamics of DEI and all these value driven, usually progressive value driven investment aspects and things like that. And of course, they're kind of beautifully captured by, the specific con man of Sam Bankman-Fried, who is, he's a Randian villain with millennial characteristics, right? He checks kind of every box, he enjoys hates suits, so he's often photographed in sort of like dirty t-shirts and flip-flops. And his entire thing is, oh, well, I'm making money to save the world. And he uses this as a deliberate distraction from a business that, makes Madoff look like an honest broker, the extent to which customer funds were used to finance the lifestyle of various members of the team. And he was able to get away with this with so many large endorsements, not only in the public space, not only was he able to capture Tom Brady and these sort of major celebrity components to promote the business, but also able to rack up a large amount of defenders and advocates within the political realm. Maxine Waters, who is very rarely known for her great charisma and affection during financial services committee hearings. Usually she's just a very obnoxious woman to listen to. She was blowing kisses to Sam Bankman-Fried during hearings dealing with crypto regulation, and she had a very good reason, right? Her campaign, her ally, her party's campaign was being financed directly by this man, and it was a man that knew deliberately the con game that he was playing. It's come up with some of the interviews he's done through Twitter DMs with various journalists, where he admits, I recognize that I could take advantage of the progressive shibboleths by checking the right boxes and saying the right taglines. In doing so, he was able to create this cover for all this this scam of a company. And I do not want to suggest that every single big tech company is just as poorly managed. That's being too light. Is as fraudulent as FTX. But we've clearly seen the degree to which these large tech companies have isolated themselves from concerns about political pressure. Whether it's Twitter hiring an army of content moderators, with a UN Human Rights Council and all sorts of extravagances, which have nothing to do with the coding of a social media website, right? They've layered themselves with these managerial roles that make them an effective partner, an ally to powerful political forces to isolate them and insulate them from political pressures. And I think that aspect of it, you can get away with that. You can get away with the bloat necessary to survive the government interventionist pressures with this low, with a low interest rate policy where you can kind of keep piggybacking off debt. But that is where this aspect of the economy, this new form of smiley face managerialism You know, to kind of piggyback off of Burnham and a little bit of Jonah Goldberg there and some of their past criticisms of fascism and things like that, or at least analysis. I don't want to say Burnham was a critic of fascism in the past. I mean, that's kind of, I think that model, it's going to be very interesting to see who sinks from this. And I think this kind of goes to a very interesting cultural dynamic that we've seen with the oligarchs of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, the philanthropy is part of the grift. And we could do a whole episode on that and probably should. Just the whole Bill Gates phenomenon, right? Exercising political power under the label of philanthropy, burnish your image, ensure your own status while you call it philanthropy and altruism, when it really, of course, has nothing whatsoever to do with that. And that seems to be the thing billionaires do now, is once you get rich, you then use your money to purchase other sorts of non-monetary power and influence, and then you talk about how you're serving humanity. It's a con. And of course, SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, was right in the middle of that. And so if you're not keeping up, Sam Bankman-Fried is the head of FTX, or rather now resigned, disgraced. And yeah, he was like a character study in how to con the media and how to buy politicians with this ridiculous sort of, hey, I'm a slob, but I love humanity. I can't even dress myself, but so that somehow means I must be a genius. And so you see him ride in ill-fitting, stretched-out T-shirts and shorts and in a famous picture from when he testified at Congress, he clearly had just bought a pair of shoes because, like, they had the factory lace on them or someone zeroed in on his shoes while he was testifying at Congress. And it was how the shoes come out of the box, where it was just kind of like the way they quickly tie up the laces in the factory. And so he clearly, I guess he doesn't know how to tie his shoes. I don't know. And so the whole thing was, hey, look, I'm this guy. I had like 4 years experience at some investment bank. Jane Street, I believe, is where he's from. And so then I managed to convince, since my parents are Stanford professors, I managed to convince some people to put in some seed money. And I talked a big game on CNBC. And actually, if you go back and you watch these clips of this guy, it's clear he doesn't actually really know very much. His answers are all very mediocre, very evasive, don't show any particular insight about markets. But I mean, just fawned all over in the media. And look, yeah, he's this new breed of billionaire, and we don't need these suits with their ties and everything. He looks like he just rolled out of bed, and let's have him on our TV show every other day to tell us all about the market. And people were dropping then, and it wasn't just institutional investors like Binance. There were apparently some pension funds putting their money in this stuff, but also just regular people who were dropping 50% of their life savings or more in these crypto exchanges, FTX specifically, in many cases. And what happened, of course, is that he was using these depositors' money, the people who are putting money in the organization, to gamble on other highly leveraged speculative investments through a sister company called Alameda Research, headed by this 28-year-old woman who he had met somewhere, I guess at Jane Street. She was his girlfriend. There was some sort of like polyamorous, amphetamine-fueled thing going at this apartment they all lived together in. And yeah, it was like, I don't know, it was the left's dream come true. It was some sort of like Plato's Retreat / Wall Street investment firm mismatch that seemed like the future. And all they were doing was stealing. They were just stealing all of your money. And they were so incompetent that Caroline Ellison, this woman who headed up Alameda Research, her and SBF together, they managed to actually lose money during 2020 and 2021, as was revealed in some news in the last 24 hours. Even though there was a huge bubble in crypto over the last 2 years, they didn't even make any real money. out of it. So, I mean, these people weren't geniuses at all. They were just ripping you off. But since they were on TV a lot and people on TV told you that they were geniuses, just pour money in there. And so I looked at this then in my article from Friday, and all of this is enabled by just the fact that there's just so much money sloshing around in the economy. So everything we're going to be talking about here for the next 20 minutes is just really made possible. These manias, these bubbles, this fact that people are just willing to write $1 million check as one company admitted it poured money into XTF FTX after a quote-unquote last-minute phone call where SBF played video games and was barely paying attention. And they were reporting that at the end of the phone call, everyone was like, oh, this is the most exciting thing I've ever been involved in. You can't get money in there fast enough. And so these people were so easily hoodwinked. But why? It was because they had to find somewhere to put all of this money that had come into the financial system. And so all of this, these trillions of dollars in newly printed money, money enabled by the fractional reserve system that the central bank backs up, it's all just pouring into the system. And when the central bank keeps interest rates super, super low, it's really hard to get any sort of yield or returns on your investment. So you're just putting it in higher and higher risk places. So if SBF is promising you some sort of miracle return, boy, we better get money in there as fast as we can before we miss out. So this combination of fear of missing out combined with the bubble, it's just astounding the carelessness and the lack of due diligence that people were engaging in.
Well, there's another component here. For one, I mean, let's not undersell Caroline Ellison's credentials. I mean, she is a self-described Ravenclaw. So, you know, she's supposed to be one of the smart ones. Her father, though, is important because her father was Glenn Ellison, who runs the economics department at MIT, which is where SEC chair Gary Gensler taught prior to joining taking over the SEC, right? And so there's a component to this where the political aspect does matter, because very, very much the same way that Theranos, right, you know, the scam health company, what was Elizabeth Holmes's top asset? It was a board of directors that included Henry Kissinger and Jim Mattis and George Shultz, right? I mean, it was saturated full of very serious, prominent political titans. I mean, this wasn't a board full of mid-level congressional members looking for an easy paycheck after retiring after a decade, looking for a gig in between lobbying members in the congressional gym. I mean, these are gigantic figures here, and very much so the mystique that Bankman-Fried and Ellison were able to build through, again, the combination of their explicit political donations and the genealogy of Ellison and its direct connection to the again, Gary Gensler of the SEC. I mean, again, the regulation, I know we don't want to focus too much on the regulation there. For a better breakdown, check out the Human Action podcast from last week with Jeff and Bob. But what's relevant here is less the particulars of the regulation and more simply the fact that, again, like Elizabeth Warren, who hates all things, market and financial services, she was holding up the regulation pushed by same Bankman-Fried as the regulatory blueprint for the crypto industry in the U.S. And so if you were a large-scale investor trying to find a safe harbor to park these excess funds in this very tenuous environment, it makes sense to try to dock it in the most politically protected harbor you could get. And FTX, looked like the most politically connected actor within the crypto environment. And again, all this was a gigantic scam. And even worse off, I mean, the question is right now whether anyone's going to pay for it, right? I mean, Sam Bankman-Fried is still getting better write-ups in the New York Times than people like Peter Thiel or Elon Musk or even Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports, right? I mean, this guy is still being promoted as some sort of misunderstood genius who just made a few bad mistakes. And golly gosh darn, he just wanted to stop the next pandemic. And you know what? The real tragedy here is that Sam Bankman-Fried's, you know, great visions for what a better humanity could look like are being undermined by this just tragic coincidence of underappreciating the amount of risk in a system. And it's like, no, like this entire system is built and rigged to benefit. I mean, what we have is a patronage network on a massive scale. And again, this is an aspect that, and none of this is new, right? You know, if you want to go, you know, if we go read our Rothbard, you can go read about how Teddy Roosevelt, right, the big enemy of trust, you know, the great trust buster, what he used is the image of trust busting to go after the Rockefeller family and the promotion of the interests of the Morgan family, who were his patrons, right? We see this throughout that, you know, all these people that try to promote utilizing political power are often doing so to benefit certain actors at the expense of others within this framework. And so again, the crackdown, the regulation of the crypto industry was designed to hurt the honest actors, the people like Caitlin Long with Custodia Bank, where she's trying to create a non-fractional reserve banking system utilizing Bitcoin and not leveraging it. And you know, there's a great clip that we've shared multiple times now on Mises.org and last week about her talking about how, like, no, like, read your Mises, understand the difference between money and fiduciary media. And this is what we're talking about with over-leveraged crypto and you know, more claims than there are for the underlying Bitcoin assets and et cetera, very interesting stuff. But that's what's going on here. And of course, the beauty of it is that the biggest benefactors of this are going to be the SEC and the regulatory agents that are directly responsible for this. Much in the same way that, you know, back when Bernie Madoff got caught, you know, the SEC did multiple investigations into Bernie Madoff. You know, you had multiple people come forward, blow the whistle, saying this guy is offering stuff that is obviously not true. And SEC, this is what you're supposed to be dealing. And every single time the SEC said, oh, nothing to see here. It wasn't until Bernie Madoff's sons, who I think, you know, and trying to do the dad, you know, sell me out so you guys don't get involved, whatever. But it took reporting, it took self-reporting to get Bernie Madoff taken down. Even though you had, again, journalists and other actors say, like, no, like, there's something smelly here. The SEC completely failed. Much the same way with Theranos. You know, it wasn't until you had a Wall Street Journal reporter that was able to get some people on the record to kind of talk about, one of them being, I believe, the grandson of George Shultz, who was on Theranos' staff and kind of realized, like, hey, there's nothing there. It took the Wall Street Journal reporters getting stuff on the record for regulatory agencies to make sure that what Theranos is selling is completely fraudulent. And they were able to bring in, you know, you had Walgreens and all these major tech giants, you know, pumping money into that. The regulatory system completely failed. And here again, and of course, again, the benefactors are the regulators who are blind, or who sleep in the job in the first place and are going to create an environment where genuine entrepreneurs, you know, non-Randian villains are going to be the ones that suffer the greatest consequences of it.
Yeah, when you see the fact that all of these people are hanging out together and they come from the same universities, they go to the same cocktail parties, have friends in common, all know each other personally, that matters. And it's not that you can't count on these people to be purely professional, and they're gonna do everything they can to regulate this guy who also happens to be his best friend's brother or something like that, right? That stuff invalidates the likelihood of serious oversight. And all these people are hanging out together. And so that's a real problem. And also, if they have motivation, there's some sort of political motivation, they're receiving money from these operations. Think of how the ratings agencies failed miserably during 2007 and 2008 to tell us anything about how these organizations were really functioning. So the watchdog groups fail when they're reliant on their gravy train a lot of the time from these organizations that they're supposed to be regulating. So yeah, it's been fun to see how people like George Shultz were so easily conned by Elizabeth Holmes, who, and of course, she received the exact same treatment when she was building Theranos, or, you know, building, quote unquote. She was putting together this con job, which never worked, and which nobody ever told her would actually work. That is, the smart people who understood the science. But nevertheless, she's feted. Bill Clinton's talking about how great she is. She's being told she's the next Steve Jobs. And people, they loved it. She was the next big thing. And that wasn't quite as reliant on so much bubble money. And she, of course, wasn't done in by higher interest rates or rising interest rates. But a lot of the same similar cultural phenomenon were involved there. And you can see how people were just willing to embrace any sort of false narrative. And it's just made so much the worse than when there's a motivation through easy money, through low interest rates, through financial repression, through a search for yield to believe this stuff because it might actually help you get rich. And so we saw all of that, all of these people who said, well, if you're not pouring money into organizations like FTX, well, have fun being poor. The people who understand the real economy, the people who are cutting edge, they're putting money in there. Well, those people who, quote unquote, should have fun being poor, they're not the ones who just lost half their life savings because they gave it to Sam Bankman-Fried.
And to be fair, within the crypto orbit, you know, you did have, and you know, some of the ones kind of most popularizing the term, you know, have fun staying poor. You do have like the Bitcoin maximalist crowd that for the longest time has been ringing the bell on, you know, keep your money off the exchanges, you know, not your keys, not your coins, right? So, and now again, you know, I think that they're, you know, there can be an exuberance there, you know, when this was a point that Caitlin Long made in that clip, right, is that, you know, when you have the broader industry being influenced by these highly leveraged companies, it creates a tremendous amount of froth in the system that can make it very difficult to make proper calculations, right? It increases the volatility of the asset. And so, you know, if you're someone like, you know, if you're buying Bitcoin and doing the right things, you know, with all the money that these leverage plays had propped into it and helped maximize the kind of that peak, the value, then, you know, you are a victim of that in spite of doing, you know, the responsible thing thereabout. And so I want to make that point before we get some angry comments in the YouTube section afterwards. But to the point too, like you mentioned, like, again, just how sinister this, and this kind of plays into it again, that the victims, the collateral damage that comes from these shady actors. You know, one of the craziest things is that, you know, you mentioned the ratings agencies where the big three are completely blind, right? The incentive structure that they had for rubber stamping, you know, all these mortgage-backed securities and all these investment products that were being, you know, pushed into, you know, innocent people's investments, not knowing, you know, trusting wrongly these major institutions. You had smaller firms like Egan Jones that were actually properly, you know, they're the first ones to you know, fly the flag on Enron. I mean, they're the ones that were warning about the poor quality of these assets, and they're the ones that end up getting investigated by the SEC for you know, oh, there's a conflict of interest here. Afterwards, again, like, you know, the people that suffer the consequences of this are the ones that are not willing to kind of just go along with the Ponzi scheme as long as the scheme is going good. And this is an aspect where, you know, again, bringing this to the broader picture of big tech, and it will be interesting to see. Again, I know there's, you know, the Mises quote about, you know, when you have interest rates go up and you have the end of easy money, you kind of, you know, you kind of have the tide come back and kind of see who's built on a solid foundation there. That's not the quote at all, but, you know, the concept is there. Again, the amount of how much of the current a big tech Silicon Valley ecosystem is inherently non-profitable and built with a political segment in mind. Because again, once upon a time, right, you know, Silicon Valley was defined by this sort of techno-punk libertarian spirit, right? Now you had the original CEO of Uber, for example, Travis Kalanick. who kind of prided himself on like sort of throwing elbows, right? Like, you know, he would open up Uber in cities and like intentionally not follow any of the regulations. And his basic operating procedure was like, look, I'm going to provide a service that your traditional taxi cab model is just not up to par. I've got an app. Come after me, bro. And eventually, you know, when your citizens get a taste of what I'm having to offer them, then you're going to come bending the knee to me, and you're going to give us the you're going to allow us to operate, whether or not you're entrenched taxi lobbyist want it or not. And this was also kind of peak at the intersection of sort of that, you know, Tea Party comes to Washington, Ron Paul libertarian movement thing. And I remember there's a tremendous amount of optimism, right? You know, you go to any libertarian conference, and it's all about how, like, techno bros were going to usher in a libertarian golden age because, you know, they care more about providing services to the customer than they do all this out-of-touch, red tape, you know, boondock, you know, like all the bureaucratic staples. And, of course, what we saw is so that, you know, the Travis Kalanick's of the world get kicked out. Right, you know, the Peter Thiels of the world get villainized and have magazine profiles, very ominous, shadowy sort of aesthetics going on. Right, the ones that had any of that sort of spirit became the villain, and attacked in a variety of ways. Elon Musk, right, the current sort of black hat of Silicon Valley, right, you know, at this time, you know, this was when he was Obama's bro. And you know, the savior of alternative energy and solar panels, and, you know, the darling of the left at this time, and now that he is taking again more of this sort of edgy come and take it mentality to regulators both in America and the bigger battle is going to be in Europe, he's now the villain again. And so, you know, there is this aspect where, you know, so much of what the promises that Silicon Valley had of overthrowing so much of the parasitic nature embedded within the economy, they became completely captured by it. Mark Zuckerberg had to make up for 2016 by financing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to fortify the 2020 election, right? And again, it's going to be interesting, again, with this changing of the economic environment and the fundamentals. Facebook is making Jim Cramer cry on camera for recommending it, you know, 6 months ago. I'm really hoping that the hard reality of an environment that has, you know, something resembling real interest rates, or at least, you know, slowly increasing interest rates, identifies just how completely uneconomic this entire dangerous, submissive, again, this tech managerial regime truly is, and that some of these bad actors just completely washed out.
It's been quite a remarkable shift in the whole techno-libertarianism thing that I was especially thinking probably around 2000, 2001, 99. It was an exciting time. You know, I was about 20 years old or so. It was an exciting time because anybody could start a blog or their own website, go on and buy your own domain and everything. And it seemed like we're decentralizing information. And we were, right? By LouRockwell.com was a very early website. It started in 1999. And back then, it was pretty much the only place you could get any sort of non-socialist, non-social democrat information on the web. And you had like three choices. You had all the establishment news sites. You had, like, on the right, you had National Review and Commentary, and that was basically it. And then the only real libertarian site with high traffic was LouRockwell.com. And Mises.org was a very early site too, and had a huge share of the internet back then because there just weren't that many websites. And so I think there was this feeling that, oh, all of this new tech, it's going to overturn the regime. And it's just as you said, Google, Amazon, all of these guys, this is all new and exciting, and they're going to this is the new wave in anti-government stuff. And boy, that couldn't have been any less true. Is there any group of people more pro-regime, more conformist, more devoted to following the rules than people in Silicon Valley? I mean, they're laughably talking about disruption all the time and all of this stuff. Oh, sure, it's fine to disrupt some tiny corner of the marketplace so long as you ultimately are backing the regime and helping your favorite oligarchs win at the ballot box. But there's no anti-establishment anything among these people. And so I would say that outside of Washington, D.C., if you had to point to a place in America that's a bigger threat to liberty and civilization and human decency, it's Silicon Valley.
And again, I mean, the tip-off should have been when Google got rid of its phrase, "Don't be evil." Should have been tip-off right there. But again, I think this is a specific insight that Oxford Economics provides this conversation, because if you go into some other sort of political realms, right, you'll have people that kind of, you know, you view this as the inevitable consequence, right? You know, whenever an industry becomes mature, it instantly starts, you know, kind of doubling down on protecting its own turf, right? And again, I think this is the component, is that, you know, what has changed that nature of big tech is the monetary policies that play a major role in how success is had within the tech industry, right? You know, you have the size of your business has direct impact on your ability for cheap credit, which is what allows you to continue furthering on. The consolidation of the big tech industry, the reason why Facebook was able to become this gigantic behemoth that wasn't just Facebook, but Instagram and WeChat and all these other entities within it, it was because they were able to finance purchases of Instagram and of these competitors at a cheaper rate. So the policies of the regime subsidize corporate consolidation, particularly within this environment. And I think within that particular industry, you have a bit of the gloss that, oh, what's up and coming, right? You know, it's sexy. You know, don't worry, you don't understand the basics anyway, because unless you're a millennial, you don't understand tech, right? So there was aesthetics as well that makes it easier for certain people to be duped, right? George Shultz would probably be less duped by a weapons manufacturer that was propping up crap, than a high tech medical company, right? So there is some aesthetic aspects that might have played into some of these particular scams and bad actors, but ultimately, though, the entire economic system of the country and really the world has been built upon subsidizing the largest, most politically collected actors and helping them create these fortified claims on industries. Any competitor that seriously tries to disrupt their hold will have all the parts of this ecosystem, whether it's Amazon Web Services, whether it is web stores, app stores, right, from Google and Apple, and the ability to access apps. I mean, this is what they're already trying to do right now with Twitter, right? There's this conversation about, oh, the Twitter app is going to be removed from these stores. And again, this is with the direct coordination of, you know, EU bureaucrats with, in the case of the U.S., the Biden administration. And it is part of this very deliberate attempt to merge private and public power. And again, this is where, you know, the question of how do you respond to it. Now, again, maybe, hopefully, we will see the stomach that Powell has in his push to increase rates to break the back of inflation. I am cautiously optimistic that Powell has more has bigger cojones than I thought he did a year ago. Right, like maybe there is a stiffer spine there than I would have given him credit for a year and a half ago, and maybe that does create a great, let's call it a great reset, in the systemic incentive structures of the economy that might purge some of this managerial excess from the system. It's perhaps, you know, it's just as likely, perhaps more likely, that we might see a pivot as the strains that this decade plus of monetary hedonism really start pressing upon these industries, and you have regime actors that do not want to lose the great power that they have obtained by these quasi-public-private partnerships. And again, this is the political dynamic of the time. And this is, you know, how do you actually try to, how do you successfully navigate this area is difficult. And, you know, this is what's fueling, you know, different attempts, you know, on the right. And I guess to a certain extent, there might be some of that on the left. I mean, maybe more some alternative platform sort of stuff, you know. Yeah, outright nationalization, actually. The push on the left is explicit nationalization rather than the perception of these big tech companies profiting from it, right? I mean, again, you've seen explicit calls to nationalize Twitter, you know, from, you know, people that don't like Donald Trump being platformed, right? And so on the left, you have explicit nationalization as a response to this. On the right, you have national conservatism and some of these other more heavy-handed, you know, the Josh Hawley approaches to breaking up big tech and things like that. Some of those, I think, solutions have bigger problems than others. But again, this is the defining environment. And again, as much as it is easy to attack and mock, and these people should be attacked and mocked, again, the cartoonish buffoons of people like Sam Bankman-Fried, listeners of this podcast will appreciate that there is a Fed response, a central bank dynamic to all of this craziness.
Oh, 100%. And someone who's done some good work on that is Brendan Brown, who's an economist, one of our senior fellows, writes for the Mises Institute. And he's been really prescient. If you go back and you read his articles about how the current boom will proceed, going back numerous years, he's been pretty good about it. He's not the sort of guy who's been constantly predicting a bust all the time. He years ago was saying, no, we're not at the bust yet, right? There's still several steps we have to go through before we get to the end. But another thing that he also pointed out was how not only does the easy money help with mergers and acquisitions, right? As you noted, it makes it a lot easier to get the sort of funding as a big organization or even as a smaller organization. But if you're already poised to borrow money, the low interest rate environment helps people who are already rich and already have a lot of assets. And so then they're able to buy out these smaller companies. But also the speculative narratives, that's a phrase that Brown uses, talking about how there's always these narratives, these stories about what's the next big company, where should you sink your money? Now, those exist in every type of market, but they tend to be supercharged when you're in an easy money environment. So everyone is out there searching for where can I pour $1 billion in order to get better returns? And it tends to favor these big techie companies that look like they're highly innovative, but which aren't actually particularly innovative. And the phrase a few years ago was FANGs, right? So Facebook, Amazon, Twitter didn't even make the cut. Yeah. Netflix, Google, I forget what the second A was on that.
Apple and Amazon.
Oh, right. Of course, Apple, right? Which is still performing somewhat okay. But they're a hardware company more than just a tech company. So they're a little bit different. But that was where you were supposed to just pour all your money. And then the confidence would be, okay, if some smaller competitor comes up, well, we'll just buy them out. And so the speculative narrative was just set on fire by the easy money. Just put money in these five or six companies and it'll be great. And you'll make a boatload of money. And look at what a genius Zuckerberg is, and we'll all be fine. And of course, you can keep that going for a while as long as there's low interest rates, because even if these companies start to get into trouble, they can always just borrow more money at even lower interest rates to pay off the old debt, because interest rates were just going down year after year after year on average. And once things turn around, then you start to get into trouble and you can't just keep borrowing to keep going. And that's why then you hear about how Facebook's going to cut 10,000 jobs. Also, it turns out it's not that easy to pick the winning horse in an economy that's tightening up. And so Zuckerberg was really doubled down on this whole metaverse thing, which just looks insanely boring. He's now laying people off because they've been pouring money into it and it just hasn't been working out very well. And now the rumor today is that he's going to resign next year as CEO. I have no idea how reliable that rumor is, but it would only surface if there's an idea that a lot of these guys, they do, it's not fun anymore for them when there's not easy money everywhere. And suddenly you might not be looking at huge returns year after year. And so then they just lose interest. They made their billions. They can cash out. I would not be shocked at all if Zuckerberg became a quote unquote philanthropist and took his billions and stopped running Facebook, because that's the natural progression of the stuff. Essentially, go into politics. That's what this philanthropy con is about. And so, sure, I think we could expect some real differences there. Also, as much as the easy money system favors all the buyouts, the extra money, the people who are already rich, once that reverses itself and you start to get in, at least no matter how briefly it might be, assuming that these companies don't get bailed out, suddenly reality comes home and Facebook becomes the next MySpace. I mean, that's always absolutely a possibility. And we've been told a million times that, these monopolies are forever. But as Brendan Brown pointed out, they're monopolies just because of the speculative narratives and the easy money. It's because it backs up their dominance in the market. But once that changes, they don't really have that same level of monopoly power that they had. So as much as we were told that MySpace was a natural monopoly and would dominate the social media market forever, it didn't, of course. So these companies can go downhill and they can even disappear. And so that's very much a possible reality. And I mean, who can really argue that these companies have improved life on planet Earth, right? Your life has not been improved by Facebook. Boy, how many studies have shown us something? It's making Gen Z depressed and sad and ruining their lives, basically. And Twitter, I mean, Twitter is a plaything for people in public relations and media. This idea that it's this key source of information and journalism is garbage. It's journalists who say that because they have a lot of influence on Twitter. So, of course, they're going to care a lot about what happens to it. I mean, it's astounding how much reporting there has been on Twitter in the last few weeks since Elon Musk bought it out. I mean, does the average reader care that much? I know from the normal people I talk to, they're not paying any attention. And they pay more attention to the automobiles that Elon Musk cranks out because they're interested in cars. They're a lot less interested in the alleged public service that Twitter devotes to journalists. So, no, your quality of life hasn't been improved by Twitter either. There was, going back to the old techno-libertarianism days, there was a recognition that if you wanted to get unusual news, that you wanted to get something that countered the narrative, you would just go to certain sites run by editors who had their own viewpoint, where things were different there, so you could go to the mainstream media and then you could go to these other sites. But what the consumers have voluntarily done is hand over the control of the news they see to a bunch of like 28-year-old cat lady hall monitors at Twitter or at Facebook who are telling them what they get to see. And so they basically put huge Silicon Valley corporations in charge of their own data, their own information consumption. You don't have to do that. That's not the way you get information. That's also another reason why it's not actually censorship. If Facebook tells you you can't view this article on their platform, you can go to the original platform that information appeared on. That's what we were doing in 2005. And we knew who was feeding us that information. There was an actual editor. There was a name on the masthead. They were telling you this info or linking you to other sites. It wasn't just some anonymous person working at Twitter or Facebook somewhere that was telling you what you get to read. But apparently you only have to be slightly more convenient in terms of delivering that information. And your grandma on her smartphone is just going to then let Facebook tell her what's going on in the world because it's too much trouble to type in the address for another website. So they've really managed to capitalize on that. But the fact that they've had so many resources and such ability to do that relies a lot on that easy money.
So now I'm a bit more sympathetic to the platforms themselves. I do think that Twitter does provide kind of unique value and how quick it is to exchange stuff. I think for running commentary, I'm a fan of the Twitter product. And I was a big fan of what Facebook had to offer as well. I think what Facebook's unique niche, and this is the only thing that still keeps it running in many ways, was the dynamic by which interactions were very much localized for the most part. And that's something that, you know, Twitter's always kind of been like this big Twitter space. And sometimes you kind of have like ideological echo chambers, right? So you've got libertarian Twitter and you got socialist Twitter, and, you know, you've got different sort of you got NFL Twitter, right? Whereas Facebook, you know, there is a dynamic, particularly with this larger environment, and perhaps one has played a role in the other, but like with the destruction of local news outlets. Again, like we have no local news where I'm at. I mean, you've got like two reporters that share like, you know, five counties. Surprise, surprise, not high quality stuff coming out of that. You know, there is a role there where and because of that, you're able to get away with certain levels of outright corruption, because you have no one kind of being able to blow the whistle and get the news out there. And again, Facebook for a while was good at this. The problem is that the nature of Facebook as a product changed, particularly after 2016, away from being an open, a public square, you know, whatever sort of metaphor you want to use, right? Away from people to come together and exchange ideas and, you know, stupid pictures and memes, to being something where it became much more of that very heavy-handed a facilitator of proper information. And so we're going to throttle back political information because that's bad for you. We don't want you to worry yourselves with this misinformation that these right-wing websites might be promoting on you. And plus it's bad for your health and it's bad for your mental health, you know, all this sort of stuff, right? And that's where Facebook itself has become completely broken. I mean, it's difficult to even just function on basic stuff like posting articles is so glitchy. And I mean, Zuckerberg shot his own product in the head. And he did so because, again, the incredible amount of political pressure placed on it after 2016, and because he was able to invest in this new kind of line of products. And again, the big one being VR and you know, the metaverse project that has now defined Facebook. I have a prediction out there that is you're going to end up seeing Facebook be spun off from Meta, and have that be sold as a different product, and hopefully get it back functioning. Again, I, as someone who deals with local news in my community, I hate that there is not a platform really to be able to have that town square element. My town suffers from a news desert, and Facebook being broken contributes to that. But again, though, would Facebook have been the platform, the mediocre glitch field product that is weaponized by government bureaucrats today, if not for the dual consequence of regulatory pressure and easy money allowing it to facilitate an entire new industry? And the same sort of dynamic you see in China, right? I mean, you've got Denny McMahon's Great Wall of Debt, right? He talks about how, like, you know, different companies that are like whiskey companies end up becoming real estate companies simply because they have access to, you know, they need to park their profits somewhere. And so, like, you have these entire industries that become consolidated within these business structures because of the quirkiness of the political and financial regime. And that does not lead to, you know, this great division of labor where you have people that are really good at these industries defining the way that capital is utilized to satisfy these ends. I mean, they're taking on these different processes of the economy at pure political necessity. And again, the more that resources in the economy are driven by political necessity rather than the meritocratic pursuit of consumer ends, that is where we get clown world. And that is very much where we find ourselves in, and we'll see how much we continue to finance that going forward.
Yeah, so I guess the interesting thing that we'll be seeing is what comes out of the next few years in terms of tech. And once the status quo of the last 20 years, it's unclear how much it can continue, right, in terms of just replacing one collapsing bubble with another, just keep printing more money, just to keep the treadmill going, just to keep the regime looking good, just to make it so that they can keep the welfare programs going, the defense sector going. And that all makes the regime look like it's rock solid, and that really helps then win over Silicon Valley power brokers into allying with the state. Now, there's always some question about how much sympathy would these people have for the state overall, right. I think they're natural allies in many cases. I have a hard time believing that Mark Zuckerberg was ever going to be some sort of Rothbardian, some sort of anti-establishment guy, even in a free market system. Pretty clearly would always have been perfectly happy with an Obama type of governance. But the fact that these companies have been so enriched by federal policy and the fact that they have to play nice with regulators has really helped move everything in that direction. And that's all helped by the fact that just generally people feel like things are fine, right? We're all getting richer, so whatever the federal government's doing, it must be fine. So let's get on their side and work with them as best we can, because of course they've got so much wealth, they're so good at picking the winners and losers. And are they really going to be seen that way 10 years from now? I have no idea. How long can they keep that game rolling? I mean, obviously they can't. It keeps going until it stops. And so at some point the dollar collapses. I don't think that's going to happen next year, but at some point that happens. At some point, the federal government starts to be overwhelmed by the debt service that it has to pay at higher interest rates, and higher interest rates start to go up because people are just unwilling to buy government debt at the levels that they were in the past, because there's just so much of it. And the only alternative then is to print money and endure high, high levels of inflation. So those things are all looming on the horizon. The question is, how well is it going to be managed? If it implodes, if they screw up in the near future, it's going to change the reality considerably. And of course, on the longer term, it's all going to collapse at some point. The question is when. So that's really the question, is how long can the feds keep buying off, both with the exercise of power and with just straight up easy money, all of these media companies, the crypto bros like SBF, they're all in it together. But it's because so much wealth and influence emanates through Washington, D.C. So there are huge, huge advantages there, and opposition is a big problem. And I think we've seen that Washington essentially won that battle against the techno-libertarian types who said, you know, come at me, I'll fight you. It turned out to not be worth the trouble for most of these people. And so they'll need to find some sort of backbone on that, assuming they even believe that's a fight they want to fight. And that's something we'll find out.
And that's why I think ultimately I'm very sympathetic to, you know, the role that, you know, elites play in changing political structures. And that's what makes people like Peter Thiel, who I'm not going to say is perfect on everything, but you do still have a little bit of a remnant of that sort of old school Silicon Valley. Balaji, Indian last name that starts with an S. He was out there promoting Silicon Valley secession at one point, as, you know, why do we need these DC bureaucrats coming in and mingling with us while we try to create the products that save the world? There is a little bit of those still within the industry. And again, I think Elon Musk kind of embodies that right now as good as anyone for any past sins and for any inadequacies he may have going forward. I mean, he's definitely taking on. I mean, I do very much enjoy to see him just mocking sitting senators with you know, Rothbardian sort of irreverence. I think that's just beautiful to see. We'll see if that comes back to bite them, right? That might be where this story ends up going too. And they're certainly threatening that. But you know, hopefully there are some of these people that have been successful, that have maintained a fortune of their own right, are interested in helping overthrow again this parasitic clown world regime. That is a threat to our prosperity and human society itself.
All right. Well, we'll have to let that be the last word on this episode of Radio Rothbard. Happy Thanksgiving for all of you listening this week. And we'll be back next week with another episode. So we'll see you next time.